Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mile 99 Interview. I'm one of your hosts, Jessica Harris. The Mile 99 Interview is a place to hang out with like-minded folks in our running community. This is the place to share stories, successes, and maybe not our so successful things. This is also the place to get the latest in local race news and find out where to volunteer. I am joined by the other half of the Mile 99, Greg Larkin. Hey, Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Yep. Just trying to get my act together here. Training-wise, I've decided to sign up for the Rattlesnake Dick 50K. I think you're going to be there as well, right?
Yes, the 25K.
Yeah. Yeah. So it looked like the timing was pretty good. I'm going to be doing Canyon's 100K. So it's nice to have another 50K under the belt right before that. Timing is good. Yeah. So I've been starting to get out there. And of course, with the daylight savings now, it's a little easier to run after work and all that. So I'm pretty excited. The weather's going to be really nice the next week. So I got to take advantage. So yeah. How are you doing?
I'm good. I forgot that I signed up for the Shamrockin' half marathon. I have not run. I had some life things happen and I haven't been doing anything, but I'm just going to go and enjoy the day. The kids will be at the finish line. So that's no matter if you walk it or run it, they're happy to see you. So doing that. And then I'll do Rattlesnake Dick 25K, which I've never run a 25K. Mm. So I don't even know how long it is. I'm just kidding. I think it's like 15 miles. But yeah, exactly. So yeah, I'm excited to do that. It's me, Greg, like neither one of us are volunteering at that race. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I know. Because one of us is usually volunteering, one of us is running, or both volunteering or something. So that'll be fun. We'll start together.
Yeah, that's right. We start at the same time. It's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it. It's a first year race. We've talked about it a few times. Martin Sengo's the RD and partnered up with North Fork Clothing, local Auburn company. And they've been providing some great swag and some other just really interesting graphic designs and things on a variety of clothing items that really commemorate this area. So definitely check them out. They're very active on Instagram. And we're really looking forward. I think we'll get to meet them in person at the race, I'm guessing. So I'm looking forward to that. And yeah, it'll be a great day. It's sold out. I think all distances sold out as well. So that's really great for a first year race. Speaking of races, there are a few others coming up. Rucka Chuck 50K. Glad to see that back on the calendar there. March 16th. That's going to be just a fantastic race. We always like that one. I've run that one a few times in the past. Great course down on the Western States Trail. And we've got the Knickerbocker Canyon Trail run coming up. And that's going to be on the 23rd of March as well. And on top of that, Folsom Lake Falcon Crest Trail run on the 30th, the following weekend. So, I mean, you can just be racing every single weekend here. That's also the same weekend there as the Rattlesnake Dick over in Cool. So we've got a couple in the area. So whatever your choice is, I believe there's actually, I think it may still be open. I believe there's a raffle for one more entry into Rattlesnake Dick. I think I saw that posted the other day. So check out their Instagram, North Fork Clothing, and see if you can sign up if you want to get an entry into that race last minute. And then we've got Placer Trail Running Festival coming up on April 13th. So if you're looking for like one final tune-up, maybe you're doing canyons or something like that, you want to get out, check out the community a little bit. They're going to be running a variety of distances from 25K to 1K. And then their 50K is also running that same weekend. So definitely check them out as well. Bad Luck Run Club puts that on. They put on a bunch of events and they do a great job. And I think they got really good reviews last year for that first year of Placer Trail Running Festival. Really excited to see them succeed. So there's so much going on. Of course, there's all kinds of 5Ks, 10Ks, and various distances. There's an Old Town Sacramento Find Your Way 5K, 10K distance April 27th. That's in Sacramento. If you're not at Canyons and you want to do something like that, go check that out. But of course, Canyons April 26th, 27th. I'm going to be doing the 100K. So I guess that starts on the Saturday, the 27th. The 100 miler starts on the 26th. Jessica, you're going to be out there again at Mammoth Bar with our friend Tom O'Donnell. He's going to be the co-captain of the aid station there. I'm looking forward to seeing you all. Who knows what the weather is going to be like this year? Hopefully we don't get a sudden heat wave the day before the race. But is it true you still need some volunteers there?
Yes, I need volunteers so bad. And you know what? Mammoth Bar is the best place to volunteer. All those other aid stations don't matter. Mine matters the most. No, it's easy to get to. Sorry, guys. Sorry. This is my show. No, I'm just kidding. Mammoth Bar is easy to get to. I bring my kids. It's close to the water. They put in some new awnings. It should be pretty nice. I have all shifts available, like middle of the night, which I've never done. So I'm mentally preparing of how to do an aid station overnight because I've never done it. So that will be exciting all the way through Saturday. And I can take anyone anytime. So message me if you are available. Canyons does hook you up with a free meal and some good credits for the Ironman UTMB organization. So they track all their volunteers and are in, from what I hear, trying to give back as much as they can to the volunteers. So that's super exciting. So yeah, I will get the link posted here soon and get signed up to volunteer. It's such a great day.
Perfect. Yeah. Join us out there. If you're not doing the race and you want to do some volunteering, it's a great way to just experience the race in a different way. If you've never done it before, it's super exciting and it's fast paced. You will not, you will not be sitting much.
Yeah. And I had someone who volunteered with me. Her name's Elizabeth Pope. I guess this should be congratulations corner, but she volunteered with me at Canyons for the first time last year. And she is running her first ultra this year because she was just so inspired by working there. So even if you're not someone who's like, I'm never going to run 100K or, and that's okay, but it does really inspire you to get outdoors and see what you can do. So the best part of volunteering is getting that personal inspiration.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to get right into the interview here in a minute. I just want to take a second to thank our sponsor, Cotula. They've been partnered with us since last year. They signed up again in 2024 here. They're a leading provider of hiking crampons, traction devices, and gaiters. And I've been using them for years, even before I moved out here to California, as you've probably heard me say a couple times. Back in New Hampshire, they were great. I used their micro spikes on a lot of mountain winter, not expeditions, but, you know, winter hikes, things like that. If you don't need a full on, you know, hard crampon, they're great. You can put them on running shoes. You can put them on hiking boots. They come on and off very easily. And then I also used their gaiters last year. And so did you, Jessica, at Waldo. I used them at TRT. Great for keeping out the dust and all decomposed granite around this area. And just some fantastic products. A really nice little company down in Arizona, really forward-thinking, very progressive. They give back a lot to the community. And we're really honored to have them on board this year. So thank you to Cotula. And if you go to their website, Cotula, K-A-H-T-O-O-L-A.com, and place an order with them, go ahead and use our code, THEMILE99, and you will get free expedited shipping for any products that you buy. So please check them out, Cotula.com, and thank you again. And now on to the interview.
Yeah, thanks, Cotula. And I believe our code works for more than just the gaiters, so the micro spikes and all the others. Snow stuff that I'm not too sure about, but I know our interview people know a lot about snow stuff. So we'll get right into it. The last time Mile 99 saw this crew was episode 23. We had them named as the Forlorn Hope Expedition, and now they are the History Expeditions crew. Tim, Hal, Bob, Jennifer, and Elka are back with us to talk about their newest expedition that just ended on the 10th. So we're so excited they're rested and coming back to the show. So welcome back to the show, Bob.
Thank you, Jessica. And we're delighted to be here. I can't believe it's been, what, hundreds of shows before. It just seemed like yesterday. And congratulations for you for having all those shows. Shows tremendous growth. And we're so happy to see both of you uplift our community. You do so much for us.
Thank you. That's why we bring them on the show, guys. No. And welcome back to the show, Tim.
Hey, good to be back.
I like your hat, like your beard, looking good.
Oh, yeah. I was trying to get into character, being snowshoe on the trail. Got to get the beard going and trapper hat. Yep.
Love it so much. And welcome back to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be back. I know it's been a minute.
I know it has, but we've seen you around, which is so nice. Well, we'll talk later about, you know, last year. That was a good year for you last year, too. And welcome back to the show, Elka.
Hey, it's great to be back. I can't believe it's been since 2020. That's crazy.
I know. It just, you guys have been busy. We've been busy. This time we saw your expedition, we're like, got to get in before they get too busy. So we were on it this year. So thanks for coming back, Elka.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And now, welcome to the show, Hal.
Thank you for having me.
So we are so excited to have you, Hal. We're going to talk a little bit about you. And I did some digging on the website, which is really helpful. Their website is
thehistoryexp.org.
Got it. Thank you so much. And so I saw on there that you ride horses.
Yes, I do.
And you've done it quite a few times.
Quite a few times and some long distances, yes.
So is this still up to date? I saw that you had 31 Tevis finishes.
I'm up to 32 now.
See, we got to update that website, guys. 32 Tevis finishes. And so that would mean that you're at 64 100 mile one day finishes or still 63?
Oh, gosh. Who keeps track after the first one? I don't know. It's in the 60s, low 60s, yes.
That's incredible. I also saw that in 2000, you were inducted into the American Endurance Ride Conference Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Is that just rider, like horse riders?
It is long distance equestrians that compete in endurance riding of anything from 50 to 100 miles in one day.
Oh.
Much like what ultra runners do.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've set the stage of you are, you know, an amazing endurance athlete. But beyond that, I think that this crew picks people who also are passionate about the history and the storytelling that goes with it. And I saw that you were an author and an executive producer about a film about the history of the Western trails. Is that right? When was that?
It's titled They Crossed the Mountains, A History of the Western States Trail, and that being the trail from Carson City, Nevada to Sacramento, California, over the Sierras.
Wow. Have you always been passionate about the trails that you've either ridden on or that you've lived by?
Absolutely. Growing up in Auburn, as I did, couldn't help but be entertained and interested in the annual Tevis Cup 100-mile one-day ride from Tahoe to Auburn. And it piqued my interest as a young kid. I was just enamored with history, particularly Western Americana. And what better way to do so by learning on the back of a horse?
Is your family do any horse stuff, or did you pick that up because of it's a fast way to get around?
Mm-hmm. No, my parents were city slickers, and no offense, but that it's just that's who they were. I, on the other hand, took an extreme interest in the competition, and then later once I was old enough to compete, did so and have been doing so ever since. Someone, one of the founders of the event, said it's a sport for the ages. So you'll have to get out there and try it.
I love watching it from a distance because they're very large animals. So I completely respect what you do. And it's incredible because you have to get, I also saw something and you can, I would love to hear about it, but you won something about not just finishing the races, but finishing with horses that were in superior conditions.
Right. Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah. There's two coveted awards, the Lloyd Tevis Cup, for the horse being in that arrives in first place. And it's like the cougar that you see over Tim's shoulder in the picture there. And the other award is the James Benally Hagen Cup. And it's awarded to the horse and rider, well, the rider, whose horse is judged by the veterinarians to be in the most superior condition of those finishing among the first 10. So the analogy would be, if you were being chased by a posse, you've robbed a bank in the gold rush days, and you're being chased by a sheriff posse, and you had 10 horses lined up, which one would you choose to continue on? And that's the Hagen Cup.
That's incredible. That is taking care of yourself and a very large creature. Because I've seen some of them come into, I've worked Tevis. From a distance, I can help. And so, yeah, that's incredible. Wow. Congratulations. How long have you known Bob and Jennifer, Tim and Elka?
Well, I've known Tim for a long time. We crossed paths many, many times, either in training or during the competition. He has a claim to fame of finishing 25 times, right? I, on the other hand, have never competed at the Western States Endurance Run, but I probably have the record. I don't know, because they don't keep track of how many times a pacer runs. So I've gone a fair amount of time and in that respect. Just never had the ability to, or the time necessary to train to get to that level of ultra trail running.
Wow, that's incredible. What's your favorite section to pace then?
Oh, last section.
Really?
Green Gate Inn. The last, what is that, 20 miles? Mm-hmm. And although I do enjoy the stretch from Forest Hill to Rucky Chucky, that's terrific. Now, you've asked me about the others. I've known Elka for a while, but Jennifer and Bob are relatively new to me, but I've known them from their excursions, their trekking with the Forlorn Hope, and then later the relief party trek that they made not very long ago. And so I've had the pleasure of meeting both of them here recently and struck an accord.
Yeah, how did you get connected and then end up getting recruited to go with them?
It came as a bit of a surprise, but Bob was inquiring with me early on, this would be about a year and a half or two ago, about if I knew of any possible other expeditions that much like what they had just accomplished. And I said, well, certainly I do have an idea. I don't know whether you'd be interested or not. So I told him a quick story about the Grosch brothers. You mentioned it earlier. And the journey that one of the brothers made with a Canadian companion over the Sierras in late 1857. And I told him the story. It piqued his interest. I think he and Tim and the others collaborated, asked for more information. I shared it with them. And it went on from there. And then I got the invite to, and I'm the newest member of the expedition team.
Love to have you. That's so great. And so, Bob, we've said the Forlorn Hope Expedition to History Expedition. Where, after that first expedition, how did you know you were going to do more? And then how did the name change? Where did that come from?
Yeah, thanks. You know, we didn't know we were going to do more than one. It was really when we didn't actually know we were going to do Forlorn Hope. Tim and I were really just looking to do some fast packing together. And we thought since we loved history, it would be fun to not just fast pack on any trail, but maybe a historic trail. It'd be kind of cool. So after reading about the Forlorn Hope, and we had both read the same book and we're talking about it on a few runs, we thought, well, let's, you know, logically, let's do that one. We'll just grab the map and go. We thought it would be a quick weekend outing. That was 7 years later, after there was no map and there apparently was no clear idea where they went. The other thing that Tim and I, we love the community, we love the run, we love history, we also love puzzles. We're both puzzlers and, you know, do the crosswords and everything every day, but we just love to put pieces together. And this became an obsessive puzzle that required throwing, you know, 5,000 pieces on the floor and pulling them together. And so the Forlorn Hope was the conclusion of that first puzzle. And I'm not sure that we thought we'd do it again, but we were so surprised at how emotionally drawn we were to the characters. So we found the trail and we retraced it. But the thing that really drew us in were the protagonists. And we got very, very, you know, committed to them, their stories, and very inspired by those. And I think that was the juice, right? That was the fuel that said, we got to do that again. Because we've all experienced the euphoria, you know, finishing an ultra and how incredible it feels, the accomplishment and the conclusion of all your hard work and maybe proving to yourself that you can do something you can't. And the euphoria that we had after Forlorn Hope was different, but powerful. In fact, I think Tim and I both said it may be the most powerful finish we've ever had. And so we wanted that feeling again. And so went looking for the next, you know, the next opportunity. And that was the Donna Relief Party, which was going the opposite direction. Once the Forlorn Hope got to Johnson Ranch in Wheatland to let people know there were people trapped at the lake, then a bunch of folks said, well, we got to go back and get them. And yet another group of brave souls went in the opposite direction. And again, history didn't really know where they went because people didn't go up into the mountains in the middle of the winter, especially the Sierra, because it's really dangerous. And so it wasn't clear what path they took. So we went about, again, researching that for some time and then retracing that and found another set of incredible protagonists that inspired us. And after we did two, I think we began to realize this is not only is it inspiring, but it's really fun. It's fun working together. We work really well as a team. We all kind of have our parts and roles to play. And I think that's about the time that we said, well, let's give it a name. And we called it History Expeditions. And since then have done two more and have found a rhythm. I think we found a place between ultra running and history and the kind of wilderness challenges that is the intersection of all three of those. And we really, we thoroughly enjoy, you know, the experience.
Well, and I really like to see the growth because like tracking you guys and you guys have, you know, big base camps now that it, you have really given people who aren't on foot with you access to what you're doing. And it's been such a joy. I've learned so much. My kids have talked about the Donna Relief Party at school, like brought in your guys' website. So it probably goes farther than you guys know or that it's reported back to you. But yeah, it's fun for you guys. It's really fun for us to watch. So I love the name change because I know there's more coming. So that's exciting. I'm going to go around and just see what you guys have done because we've missed you so much. The podcast has missed you so much. We're going to let me know what you guys have been doing since 2020. Elka, what have you been doing?
Gosh, well, as Bob mentioned, we finished our fourth expedition. So, you know, that's always really fun to train for, especially given that it's not a race. This is more about honoring the story that we're telling and the route that we are following. So that's been a lot of fun. As always, trail stewardship, that's near and dear to my heart. You know, I don't really keep track of how much of that I do, but especially since the mosquito fire, you know, that that has really kept us busy. And on that note too, for the Canyons trail prep, I do have 5 trail work days that I posted on Facebook that with a link that volunteers can sign up for. Those would be March 23rd and 24th, April 6th and 7th, and then our final one will be on April 13th. The first 4 days will be up in the Burn area, El Dorado on Loop 6. And then that final last day, April 13th, will be in the Auburn State Rec area. I'm working on trails and I could really use some volunteers. So if anyone has time and inclination, I would love to see you out there. Other than that, crewing for Cole Watson last year at Canyons and at Western States was really great and fun. It's awesome to be able to crew for a really fast runner. It's more like a quick pit stop rather than, you know, being the psych ward. And then also a couple of smaller races. I do aid stations at Bishop High Sierra as well as Mammoth Trail Fest. Mammoth Trail Fest, I also run one of those days. That's been really fun. And then Chloe, my daughter, ran Javelina this year, so was able to crew for her and pace her a bit too. So just keeping busy with mountain trips and trail work and, you know, crewing, all that type of stuff. It's been really fun.
Thanks for all you do, Elka. And Jennifer, what have you been doing?
So since the last time we talked, let's see. I know it's been so long. I did a little bit more adventure racing with a Team Ben from Eco Challenge. We did an all-female team just to bring some awareness to the fact that for a lot of adventure racing teams, women are considered mandatory gear, much like a rain jacket or pair of, you know, climbing gloves. So we were trying to bring awareness to the fact that, you know, that a woman can be more than just one person or a piece of gear. It can be a whole team of women, or it can be two women. So we raced as 4 women to bring awareness to the fact that we want women to feel like they can race on an all-female team or a more than 25% female team.
I love it. I think Jennifer's paused for a minute. So while she gets back on, Tim, what have you been doing since 2020?
Ooh, yeah. Well, training my second Vizsla. Let's say hello, Miles.
Hi, Miles.
Miles is our new trail companion here. But yeah, he helps us research the trails. You know, Bob and I are captain the aid station at Brown's Bar at Canyon. So that's a hoot. We get the goats out there, which is the, you know, our kind of fledgling running club called the Grays of Auburn Trail. So the goats, you get it. You can spell it out. That's a lot of us that have kind of been over the top of the hump on the training thing and racing thing. And now, you know, it's about, you know, helping everybody else out, doing aid stations, trail work, and the other things that go with that. You know, trying to read some narrative nonfiction books. So that gives us some more ideas on expeditions. There's this new book coming out by Hampton Sides about the Captain Cook and sailing. Maybe we'll have an expedition sailing around the Hawaiian Islands. That sounds pretty good. And let's see, my oldest son had a grandson, our first grandson, a few months ago. So that's another distraction of goodness to go and hang out with him. So yeah, good stuff.
That I didn't know. Congratulations. Yep. Yeah. Yay. Grandpa Tweetmeyer. I love it so much. Bob, what have you been doing since 2020?
Yeah, similar to Tim. So we're up to four grandkids now. And so that's a big part of our life. We're thrilled from 7 to 1. And when we're not with them, you know, as Tim said, we started goats up to kind of get, I think Tim and I are in sort of the same place. We're not racing much anymore, but we like to be out there still. And so it's giving back, paying it forward through volunteering, whether it's at Western or trail work or working with Canyons and others, you know, trying to help people like Elka and Chaz and Western States crew and Craig and all that. We do the international reception every year, which you guys are kind enough to now be our volunteer herders. And so we invite all of the international runners from Western States to come to a special picnic on Wednesday before the race. And it's special because it's all about them, but a lot of the guests are the families that host them and maybe put them up or provide pacers or provide logistics. And then we also invite a lot of Auburnites that have been involved with the race for many, many years. And everybody just hangs out like a backyard barbecue, real low key, and it's a hoot. It's a lot of fun. So we have a good time with that every year as well. But, you know, a lot of time is obviously increasing amount of time going into history expeditions now where we finish one up and already start thinking about, you know, what's next. Because it takes about a year for us to pick it and research it and get out in the field and spend all the time, then get out there and do it. So there's a little bit of a off season, and then we kind of get right back at it.
That's so fantastic. And I just want to call out to the, you know, you talked about the international picnic. That was such a great experience from my standpoint. And I'm still in touch with some of those people that I met that night. So it's just the connections that you make and just welcoming all of them to the Auburn area and just really, you know, rolling out the red carpet. It's such a great concept. And so thank you for thinking of that many years and involving us with it.
Yeah, that's good to hear. You know, Marcy and I were overseas for 7 weeks this year, and we stayed with or visited with, I think, six or seven of our international friends from country to country. It really works that way, and they're very grateful for Auburn and the greater Auburn area rolling out their homes, making them feel at home, and they very much want to return the favor. So anyone out there interested in pacing, go to the website, Western States Waves, sign up. And there's a lot of international runners that need pacers because they don't use pacers anywhere else other than the United States for the most part. So it's a new concept. And of course, it's a huge advantage to have a pacer, particularly somebody that knows the trail. So we certainly, and it's just a lot of fun. You really get to know some wonderful people. And the favors returned when you go visit them in their home. And some of them live in some fairly exotic places. So get out there early and choose the choose the runners from the best places.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to pace someone from Switzerland. And best pacing gig I've ever had. I mean, we love pacing our local friends and stuff. But those, I remember every step. He was so fast, too. It was really fun. So, Jennifer, you're back on. We heard about your all-female team. What else have you been doing?
Oh, so I don't know when I got cut off, but I think I was saying that I was lucky enough to get into States last year after another 7 years. It was my eighth year getting back in the lottery. I was the first person picked in the lottery that was local. So that was super exciting. And I got to do my Lake Sonoma canyons, the new canyons course, saw millions of hugs out there on Canyons Day. I didn't mind the heat. So Greg, don't worry, hot at Canyons. You know, I can show you there is shade for about 2 feet. If you just stay on the time track I was on, I actually managed to run in the shade for most of the course.
Nice.
And I just sort of embraced the running up the pavement, which you won't do this year. But I just said, bring it on. You know, it can't be worse than our expedition last year involved carrying a full-size backpack, 60 pounds, up the Western States Trail that had not been cut back yet. So we're talking hot, climbing over lots of trees with a backpack and a couple pairs of snowshoes. So Canyons is going to be a piece of cake no matter what the weather is, Greg. So don't worry.
Love it.
And then Western States was a family affair. I had my whole family, my son's girlfriend, Hal, and Ann Hall. So I had professionals waiting for me at Michigan Bluff to rub my legs. And my husband and MJ and Nikki Kimball pacing me. You can't ask for a better team. So I had a fantastic Western States, and it was super fun. So I feel super lucky for that. And I am back to just doing the expedition and focusing on my kids. My son is graduating from high school. Mm-hmm.
Oh, might have lost again, but all right. So we got the update from the whole team here. So thanks all. Very busy, obviously, trying to fit in all the expedition planning as well. As we heard, it takes quite a while, a year, getting everything in place here. And so we definitely want to move into talking about this expedition. And I think maybe the leading question is just a general one. Who is Snowshoe Thompson? What was the kind of reasoning behind picking him as another person to follow in the footsteps of? And I guess I'll throw it out. We talked a little beforehand. Maybe either Tim, Hal, or Bob, one of you kind of want to take that on and talk about the origins of this expedition.
Yeah, I'll give a brief summary and then let Tim and Hal fill in. So Snowshoe Thompson lived in the mid-1800s. He was born in Norway, Telemark, Norway, and emigrated at age 10 to the United States, New York, and then went to the Midwest with his mother and half-brother. And they spent quite a few years in the Midwest, but ultimately he heard about the gold rush. And in 49, he and his half-brother emigrated to California, to Placerville, Hangtown at the time, and to try their luck at gold mining. He was in his mid-20s. And he had limited success, as most people did, and so got frustrated and ultimately was kind of casting about, met a guy named Knott, and Knott was putting in a gristmill and a sawmill up in Genoa, which was the Utah territory at the time, was before Nevada existed. And so he went up and worked for this gentleman. John Thompson was really good with his hands. He was 6'2", 180 pounds. 20-something years old. The guy was strong and he was resourceful. And so he worked on the gristmill and the lumber mill, but then Knott had him start to move some mail back and forth across the Sierra. And that's where he got his first inkling about the need. Because in the winter, what had happened was people in California were trying to get mail back to anywhere east of the Sierra. And the snow was blocking any kind of carriage of mail over the mountains. People had tried snowshoes, they tried sleds, they tried wagons, nothing worked. In fact, it was incredibly dangerous. And Thompson saw the need, and the postmaster in Placerville put out the call in 1855 and said, hey, we need some way to get the mail across the country. Is there anybody that would volunteer? And he did. And he volunteered and said, I'm going to do it alone. And I'm going to do it on foot, but I'm going to have what he called snowshoes on. And what he meant were 12-foot wooden skis. They're made out of oak. He made them, and they weighed 25 pounds. No one had ever seen anything like this before. He had grown up on skis in Norway, and so for him, it was secondhand. And so he got the job and said, not only am I going to take the mail to Genoa, but I'm going to do it fast, like really fast, in less than a week. And everyone thought he was crazy. And his first trip was January 3rd, 1856. And he made it from Placerville to Genoa in 3 days. Remarkable. It's 100 miles, 30,000 feet of climbing. He did it with paraskis, about 60 pounds of mail on his back, very little food. And he didn't stop much. So he was an ultra person. He would move at night because it was the snow was crusted, and sleep during the day under the sun. But he didn't sleep much. He'd sleep 30 minutes, a nap here, nap there. And that's what he had to do in order to get there in 3 days. And his return trip from Genoa to Placerville was 2 days. So, and he did it twice a month. So he's doing 400 miles. He's doing 60,000 feet of climbing. And he was doing it in 10 days, twice a month. Absolutely remarkable. So one of the things that we noticed quickly as we began to study this guy is he was an American West ultra athlete before we knew what that meant. In addition to being a great human and generous, and he did this on and off for 20 years until he passed away, ironically, of an appendicitis at age 49. He was very young. So, but through those 20 years, from 29 to 49, he carried the mail back and forth across the Sierra when no one else could. And he did it on his skis, and he did it rapidly and with tremendous amount of risk that he was taking, but saved a number of people's lives along the way. There's some great stories, encountered some wild animals, but never really had tremendous peril, which is remarkable over 20 years. And from what we researched, he was also a giver. He gave to a lot of people his time, his effort. He was a farmer. And so we just thought he was a remarkable human being, and we had a special affinity to him because he was an ultra, a different kind of ultra athlete. And so that's what attracted us to his story.
Anything else to add to that, Tim or Hal?
Yeah, I'll add just a couple different things. Yeah, what Bob said, the guy was an athletic freak. I mean, in a positive sense of the word. I mean, he had to be, to do what he did, to be an elite skier, like, you know, world-class Olympic level skier. And if you see those skis that he was using, the only thing I can describe it is they're really fast going straight ahead. But if you're carving turns or you're trying to move through tree wells or whatnot, you know, it's very sketchy. And, you know, I'm sure he got injured once or twice, probably didn't ever talk about it, but you can imagine skiing that much in that kind of terrain. It's quite difficult. The other thing that we kid about, a couple of different things, is Frank Tortorich, who literally wrote the book on for Snowshoe Thompson. He was there with us, the start and the finish of our trek, said, you know, when you're born in Norway, you don't get booties, you get skis. Much like a Canadian, you get skates, you don't get booties. And they learned to ski from the time they can stand up. So this was a natural fit for him. He probably thought, how does the job ever get better than this? Other than the fact that we know the government really never paid him, even though he was theoretically working for what would be the post service. He was actually a contractor. He really not got paid for that. But he did start, what do you want to call it now, a side hustle? So he was moving equipment, letters, and other things back and forth between Placerville and Genoa and back for people, medicines, printing, utensils. And so, you know, we've got our little replica things here, and I can show you this little thing. And this was his personal postage stamp that he put on the mail that he carried across the mountains. Thompson's Carson Valley Express was the way he differentiated his mail from that might have been carried down to Sacramento and then somewhere else. Or the other way to get it out with her was to send it down to San Francisco and then sail it around, you know, Panama or wherever they had to take it. And it took a lot longer. So his, you know, when you think about it, he was FedEx way before FedEx, right? He was the original FedEx. And as I noted to some of the guys on the TV thing, when you think about even today, what's super important day to day and as fast as you can get it, communication. It boils down to communication. And what was his skill? Fast communication, faster than anybody else could do it in the most extreme conditions. And that's what really made him a hero then. And now.
Yeah. And the one thing that I've noticed too, I mean, looking at pictures of him, drawings, I believe there's even a statue up in Olympic Valley, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
You're right.
The technique, I mean, when we think skiing, and I'm a cross-country skier, but this was something completely different. I mean, as you said, the skis are huge, they're heavy, but he's only got one pole, and it's almost used as a rudder in a way, it looked like, more so than, you know, what we would consider even cross-country skiing these days. So just the technique and everything else that he's using is just different, but that was what it was at the time, from what I could tell.
That's right. They call it longboard skiing, and those still go on in Plumas County right now every weekend, longboard skiing, and they have the 12 feet minimum length. Some of them get up to 20 feet long, and no poles. And Tim showed me a picture yesterday. You know, if you know headwall at Olympic Valley, it's a sheer drop. They have a similar headwall up in Plumas County. This point, those imagine pointing 15-foot wooden skis off the edge of that, and that's what they do. And there's no turning. You just go down the hill as fast as you possibly can. Jen likened it to, you know, the videos we see of people chasing those cheese wheels down the hill, right, every year. It's very similar and breathtaking, but it's the tradition has gone on. He also is in the Hall of Fame, the Ski Hall of Fame, as one of those that is noted to be the father of United States skiing. He was one of the very first to introduce, certainly the first to introduce it to the West. Mm-hmm. And ski jumping, he introduced ski jumping and was the precursor to the Auburn Ski Club, the infamous Auburn Ski Club, which opened up skiing to the entire Western United States. So that all can be tied without any effort back to John Thompson.
Fantastic. And so as we get into this, I mean, you're all kind of coming together. And, you know, I'm sure, like, sort of talking this out and figuring out, you know, what the next expedition is going to be. The route planning has to be one of the biggest pieces of this, I'm guessing. I mean, you don't really have a lot of records from what I understand. Who all between you, you know, got involved in that specific piece of it? And what did that entail? Just trying to figure that out research-wise and then on the ground. And I'll throw that out to whomever, I guess, was most involved in that part of it.
I think Hal was going to take that one right now.
Yeah. Is that Hal?
Okay. I'd be happy to. Yeah. No, our primary goal to the research was, to the best of our abilities, to determine the route that this Norwegian had taken between Placerville and over the Sierras to Genoa, Nevada. And we came to find out that Thompson didn't write anything down, he didn't draw any maps. But what he did like to do, he enjoyed an interview. And so now his reach went actually beyond Placerville to the west, to Sacramento, and to the east. He went as far as Cold Springs Station in the middle of Nevada. But when right after his first inaugural journey across the Sierra, the Sacramento Daily Union interviewed Thompson, and, you know, to get his account, how it went. And following that, whenever he was, he'd pick up the mail at the St. Charles Hotel on I Street in Sacramento, he'd go and knock on the door of the Sacramento Daily Union, and you could read all of the articles that the reporter accounted for. So it did give us some names of locations that he was traveling over. In addition to that, I think Tim mentioned Frank Tortolich. I'll just put up his book. This book was really a good lead for us in terms of determining what routes he did take. And by the way, he was always looking for a better way of going. So he was all over the map. He found his way as far south as Murphy's, California, as far north as Cisco Grove on Interstate 80, and for a short while, and elsewhere. But the route we took this last week was his best route from west to east. So we were able to identify from our initial field survey in last October just what those locations were and where he might have traveled by. Just the theory of least resistance. So from our field survey and actually getting on the ground, we found where Thompson went. And I think we can all say that we gained a great deal of respect for what he can do or did do as an ultra athlete. And I was primarily responsible for mapping the route, utilizing today's technology, and so that we wouldn't digress too far off the route that we think he took back in the day.
Yeah, I'll give you just a little bit of insight. You know, that first day that we went back is Hal and Bob and I, we spent the evening at my cabin, then spent an entire day. We went across Lake Tahoe and up to Echo Lake and checked out the pass because we knew that would be the trickiest part of the route. Then went down and checked out his cave that's out on Highway 88 along just, you know, a little bit down the hill from Pickett's Junction. Went into Genoa to see the statue and what that town was like and where we could finish. And then we actually had, this is where some of the fun stuff is. We met some historians. The people we meet, that these historian people are fantastic because they have all the relics of Snowshoe Thompson, some of them. And then, so in this case, we went to the Gardnerville Museum, and they had a room just with him. And, you know, Bob and Hal and I, we had like an hour. And so the lady's like, we got to stop at 3:30. She had someplace to go. And so we're just like a bunch of kids in a candy store trying to get information. Everything looked as different than we've ever seen, and notes. And we were like, oh, we got to come back here. An hour's not enough time. We've got to keep digging. But that's kind of how it goes. You know, multiple weekends, Jen and Bob went out, and, you know, everybody kind of tries to catch a piece of the trail and find out where the tricky parts are. And then sooner or later, you've solved the route puzzle.
Very nice. Yeah. So you're taking all that collected knowledge from being on the ground, museum research, books, notes, historians, other people, putting that all together. I mean, I'm starting to understand why it can take upwards of a year to get this all right. I mean, it's just so much now. And also talk a little bit too. I mean, this is not the California of 1856. I mean, there's roads, there's developments, and how much, you know, are you impeded by all of these current modern developments?
Yeah, no, it wasn't easy because for quite a bit of the route that he took is U.S. Highway 50 from Placerville. It digresses here and there, but for the most part, it's Highway 50. So we had to be very careful. And how many times did we cross Highway 50? Four or five, six times?
Enough times.
Too many times.
Yeah.
Enough times to not draw attention to ourselves. But
that's right. We had a river to cross. He crossed it. That was challenging in and of itself. The water was high. And we took the safe route, which was we boated across, rafted across. So we had in our travels forested landscape, a high desert, including, say, three river canyons, two mountain passes, three valleys, one small and one large lake just to experience.
Amazing. I did see that there was some discussion that there might have been a bridge at the time he was traveling across the South Fork. Have you gotten any definitive confirmation of that?
Yeah, the bridge was built. When he first started in January of 1856, the route was still a crude path. Wagon roads hadn't even been built yet. California didn't pass their Wagons Road Act until late 1855, but the routes had not even been surveyed. I mean, they were being traveled upon by, you know, the immigrants traveling west, you know, across the plains and the Great Basin, reaching the Sierra Nevada, but there weren't any wagon roads. Now, by 58, 59, the roads were being built and improved upon. So the bridge that we had hoped was in existence has long since gone. And so that's why we had to raft across. You know, late in the year, October, we would have been able just to walk across the river, no problem. But those are the challenges that we had. And again, he helped open up the West, really, if you think about it. His journey back and forth all year round, winter, spring, summer, and fall. You know, of course, in the winter with the skis, he called them snowshoes. You know, helped open the West by carrying that mail. And later in the summertime, starting his business, as Tim mentioned, by, you know, carrying supplies and whatnot across the mountain passes by wagon, mule, or horseback.
Just the more I hear, it's just an amazing, amazing thing. I had heard of him, I think even, you know, somewhat before, you know, having seen the statue and just kind of done some reading, but this is really filling in a lot of gaps. And the one thing that, you know, I do want to talk about also is just kind of for each of you, we talked prior to the show, just kind of walking us through each of the different days and just kind of hearing, you know, what was happening during any specific day and then the night, you know, because you all gather around a campground, campsite that's been set up. We'll talk about your crew as well a little bit. So I just wanted to kick it off a little bit, you know, talking about some of those planned stops, gear, food, you know, the camp that's moving along the route with you. And so Jennifer, I don't know if you wanted to take us kind of through that first day and just let us know how did it all start off and how did it go that first day with the anticipation of it?
Well, I'm going to start by saying if I freeze, I'm really sorry, and I'm sure anybody can take my place. But we started on day one in Placerville next to a very small and unassuming, I call it yard art, of Snowshoe Thompson. There are some magnificent statues of him. Placerville is not sporting one of them. So it's a little teensy tiny yard art of Snowshoe Thompson. So we left from there, and I call that our Pony Express marathon day. So we covered almost 26 miles, a lot of pavement, but we left on the bike path. Anybody can do this that wants to, and you can run out of town. We were hosted by the, I think it's the El Dorado Historical Society, a woman named Jill Kearney. They brought us muffins and coffee and brought Frank Tortovich of the preeminent book on Snowshoe Thompson to see us off. So Tim quickly grabbed as many muffins as he could. I believe Hal stuffed some down his pants or something. Yeah. We had a chat with a bunch of muffins, and off we went on the pavement and quickly realized we're a little old for running on cold pavement. It's like doing CIM as a bunch of ultra runners. But we were so lucky the day before Bob had asked Craig and, you know, Craig Thornley and Matt Keys very nicely, hey, there's this gigantic river crossing. You guys think you could get us a boat? And they were like, you mean like hike in a boat? Yeah, like hike in a boat. So they went and got the resources to get a raft down there, like Hal said. We didn't fall into the Class 5 Rapid. We were able to get boated across in luxury. And we did a snow slush schlup fest all the way up to Ice Road, where we camped on the side of the road in a hairpin turn, which did not look attractive, but actually was a beautiful camp. And we had a fantastic time the first night eating Marcy's fantastic minestrone soup with fresh bread that Elka got us from Jen in Auburn, the jalapeno cheddar. So we eat very well, and we had a big fire pit, and Craig and Matt rubbed our feet for us, I believe, and nobody told any silly stories or had any whiskey or did anything like that. We just went right to bed. No, but it was a long day.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it, and you have to kind of set up a little bit of a routine, I'm guessing. I mean, you want to get in, you know, before dark, and we'll get to the snow and all that also, you know, and make sure you're out of camp in the morning. You do have a support crew. We can touch on that maybe at the end of this section here. But, you know, kind of reading some of your posts and all that and timing and everything else, I mean, it sounded like in the mornings you tried to break camp, like you'd be up for a couple hours kind of breaking things and getting ready and be on the road by, or on the trail, let's say, by 8:30 in the morning, if I remember correctly. So that takes you like kind of right into day two. And Bob, do you want to pick up the story from there?
You bet. Yeah. In fact, day two, we were out by 7 because we're going to be in snow all day, and we're at 5,000 feet there. So since the huge storm had come in just a few days before, there was about 3-4 feet up in Kybers and Strawberry up that area. So we wanted to get out early in the hopes that we would have firm snow, at least for a few hours in the morning. And I might add that all of day one, where we encountered sloppy conditions, and we did, all of us had Cthulhas on, by the way, a remarkable, remarkable bit of footwear, saved our bacon a number of times. So on day two, we carried our Cthulhas with us in the hopes that, wishful thinking that we would have less snow as we went into the day. And it was absolute slugfest of us against the snow on snowshoes, because we were sinking down 3 to 6 inches every step. And even at 7 a.m., it was Sierra cement. So we had a half a day of what we thought was going to be going downhill, but turned out we were going uphill more than downhill. Just torturous snowshoeing. I mean, every time you pick your foot up, you know, you're stepping up, but you're also bringing up all the wet snow on top of your snowshoe, knock it off, take another step, and so on. So we were moving, we were blazing out there at a mile and a half per hour, and it just was endless. And we got to lunch, and there the snow was even heavier up and a little bit lighter in Strawberry, I guess, but we actually decided to come backwards on the course through Lover's Leap in that area, simply because it's so beautiful. You can see Pyramid on the right if you're going backwards, and Lover's Leap on the left. And we had Keith Sutter, our incredible photographer, with us. And so he embedded and had some phenomenal photos. So the afternoon we spent in the snow again. It was a little better, and the beauty of the theater we were in sort of distracted us enough. But I will say, by the time we got to Myers and struck camp, we were tired puppies. And it turned out that the camp that we had set out forgot we were coming, so they were buried in 6 feet of snow and had to quickly get their backhoe out and clear a couple of spots for us so we could get our vehicles in there and have the crew and set up camp. So we were homeless there for a little bit, but it always works out in the end. And that was a very, very satisfying end of day two. We all slept on the snow. A couple of people snuck into the bathroom and curled up on the floor there. We'll do whatever we have to do to get sleep. But it was a really full day two for us. And that put us at 60 miles into the trek.
Wow. That's some amazing progress, I would say. Yeah. And then Elka, you had to join a little bit late, I heard. You came in on day three. So do you want to kind of take it from there?
Yeah, sure. I had the misfortune of having a pretty bad flu the week before the expedition, and I needed a couple more days to get myself well enough to join the team. And it sounds like that was a really good call for what they went through on days one and two. You know, I think that was definitely a good call. So what I ended up doing is Friday morning, I left Auburn really early. I knew we were going to be hitting the road at 7:30. So I drove from Auburn to Myers to meet with the group. And once everybody got together, number one, I never want to have to miss a single day of a future expedition. It was excruciating, very sad watching them on the tracker, knowing that, you know, they were out there and I wasn't with them. So having that reunion was awesome. So once we got going, it was on foot. We went through Christmas Valley for a few miles. Then our crew, due to the snow levels and the depth of snow, it was really too dangerous for us to be on 89. So our crew gave us a ride up to the top of Luther Pass, which is near Grass Lake. And at that point, we went from our running shoes to skis for the first time on the expedition, which was really exciting, except for the fact of, you know, none of us are really big skiers, but we had Nordic skis essentially with metal edges. Bob had some kind of AT skis with a different type of binding, but we all got our skis on. Keith, our photographer, was with us. He had his AT skis, and out of all of us, he probably is the most experienced in those types of conditions, which, you know, again, goes back to what Hal was talking about and Tim and Bob with regards to the skis that Snowshoe Thompson wore through the same area. So we were going through trees, and I don't know how he did that on skis that were that long and maintained any kind of control, because it was Comedy Central for us. It was, you know, you'd be up for 30 seconds and then you were down. And you get back up, go down a little hill, and we all just kind of crashed. And one of our favorite sayings is, you know, man down. And you'd either be on pressed skiing or you would sink in, you know, wet, heavy snow. So it was rinse, lather, repeat until we got down to Hope Valley. And at that point, it was just beautiful skiing across the valley on nice, crusty snow, which I highly recommend people to go out there. It's just wide open, beautiful views. After that, we were able to go visit the Snowshoe Thompson home site, which is in Diamond Valley, an absolutely beautiful spot. I mean, I think we can all agree that any one of us would love to have a home there in that particular site. So that is near Woodford's, Diamond Valley is. And we spent quite a bit of time there just talking about the views and talking about where his home site was. Of course, he was married a short while after he got his first place there to his wife, Agnes. And then after that, the group went up and visited the cave that is on 88 that I think Hal mentioned earlier. And that was a lot of fun. We probably should have worn snowshoes. We did a lot of post-holing on that one, but we were all able to fit in the cave. And, you know, we just talked about what Snowshoe must have been doing when he used that cave. Obviously, he's traveling very quickly to get across the Sierra. So we assumed that he probably just rested there for a couple of hours, built a fire and just rested, maybe had a little snack of dried beef before he continued on. And then that night, we set up camp at Grover Hot Springs, and Jen and I stayed behind along with Keith, and all the guys went to the hot springs and they were able to, you know, sort of bathe and relax there before we all were able to enjoy dinner made by Jen. It was absolutely delicious, and sat around the campfire and told stories. It was a great day. And again, super happy to be reunited with the team.
Yeah, definitely. And I've seen, some of the videos. I mean, you spend a lot of time just kind of talking about the day, sharing stories with each other and the crew and all that. And that just seems like a really fantastic way to just kind of wrap it up each day and then send yourselves off to some well-deserved sleep and on to the next day. So Tim, day four, I mean, you're already very far into this, you know, how's everybody feeling? What's the mood like? You didn't hit any like weather events during the trip, as far as I can understand. Is that right? Like you didn't have to worry too much about the weather window or anything?
No, actually Friday was gorgeous. It was the only really clear sunny day. So that helped a little bit warm everybody up. That's one of the things that's really hard on an expedition like this. And we always kept asking ourselves, how did Snowshoe do it? Because like Bob mentioned on day two and even Elk on day three, skiing or snowshoeing takes a lot of effort. But you can't get all sweaty and you know, worked up because you can't stop. You really, if Snowshoe was going through, he could have only stopped for a little while, because if he's all sweaty and stops, he's going to get cold right away. And that's when you, like Elka mentioned, in his cave, it looked like he just had a place where he could sit down, lean on his mailbag, and then he had a little place for fire, but there wasn't really a place to lay down. It was like he goes in there and sleeps for 8 hours and wakes up the next morning like we did. So you're trying to knit through all the, how did this guy do this, when you see all these places and it kind of connects the clues. So we were leaving Grover Hot Springs because we broke camp a little bit later because we'd had three really busy days and thought, well, maybe we could just sleep a little bit in. It's kind of hard to sleep in when you're sleeping on the snow and the sun comes up at 6. But that was a great morning. Everybody was kind of rallied. And it wasn't going to be a super long day because we were going to be back on the road now. The rest of the trip is on roads paralleling the old immigrant route. One thing you know about this route, whether Genoa to Placerville, is Genoa got famous because it was both on the immigrant trail for all the people coming across for the gold rush and all that other stuff. It was also on the Pony Express route. So it has quite a bit of history in the Old West. So we broke camp and got out, and we were starting back at Woodford's today. So we got from there. Woodford's is a pretty famous spot. It was one of the original Pony Express exchange stations. So this is where they'd have horses, and one rider would stop and hand the bag to the next guy, and the other person would take off with their horse. It wasn't long before they kind of abandoned that route and went over Kingsbury, but it was kind of cool because Woodford's just this little small town. So we took off out of there. And it was funny because it was really nice and sunny that morning, but then the wind came up and the clouds came in and it got pretty cold. We were running in, you know, tights and wind pants and jackets and had our beanies on and stuff, gloves, because probably 20, 25 mile an hour winds, which was kind of good for a while because it was behind us. But then later on, it wasn't so much behind us. And we went down what's known as the Old Immigrant Trail. It's actually a road, but the Immigrant Trail is just off to the left through some private property. So we were able to parallel it pretty closely. And we actually got stopped by one of our friends, Bill Holmes, who was the gentleman who got us onto Johnson Ranch for both the Forlorn Hope and the Donna Relief start. He was tracking us. He was on his way down to Independence. He has a house down there. So he was watching the tracker and just ran us down on the roads. It was great to see him. Such a good guy. It was great to see him come and support us. Not too long after that, we went across the California-Nevada line. And all it is a 4x4 on the side of the road. One side has a sign that says Nevada, and the other side just says California. And then there's a white line diagonally drawn across the road to stay on the boundary. So that was kind of knowing we were now transitioning from California to Nevada. Then we ran by Fredericksburg, which what you realize on these old Western towns is there may not be a town there anymore, but there's a cemetery, and that's what's left behind. It reminds me of the one down at Slagger Mine Road. You know, it's out in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing around it. But at one time, that was where everybody ended up. And one thing you notice about Genoa when you've been around enough, those cemeteries have names that have been in that area for generations upon generations upon generations. And so you see people names in there that you might notice. And there were others in the Genoa cemetery, which we did later that day, like Van Sickle and Gansberg and these names that Scassa, which Scassa is a name that when Agnes passed, when John Thompson passed away, Agnes remarried to John Scassa, and she lived out there. The Scassa family is still in that area today. So 1860 to, you know, 2024. So we moseyed on down, and we ended the day at a place called Fay Luther Trailhead. It's a trailhead for hiking and horse riding about 10 miles south of Genoa. And that's where we were going to camp that night. Bob, through some good contacts, was able to get us to camp there because it's really a no camping zone. But the guy that runs the whole trail system said, oh, no, I'll just come out and hang out with you guys. So it's just a dirt parking lot on the edge of the road and between that and the mountains on the east shore of Lake Tahoe. So we got in there about one, and we didn't really want to sit around. It's kind of cold and windy. So we went into town because we wanted to go see kind of all the layout. So we went into town and then went to the cemetery so we could kind of see where that was and visit John Thompson's tomb. And Agnes and Arthur are buried right next to him, as well as, again, you go through the families of all the people that have run that area in the last 150 years, Van Sickle, Raycraft. You know, Van Sickle's still there. Raycraft was I think they were stage drivers and hotel owners. And I mean, you go through all the other ones, trying to think, Hellwinkle, and just you see all these names, and then you ask, and Scassa was again in there. And when we came in, we went there and went through there. And of course, if you ever really want to go just your own research, Bill. Just Bill in the Genoa Cemetery, great story, miner that got killed by a rock that hit him in the head. And so they took that rock and put it in the cemetery and just carved it as Bill. So he's not too far from Snowshoe, but it's really fascinating to go through those places and learn other families that ran the show. And then we had to get back to camp early because we had to get Jen's chicken Alfredo cooked and down, as well as another loaf of grilled cheddar and jalapeno bread. And then Bob had arranged to have some folks come out and sit around the campfire and let us tell stories. And much like the other nights, Hal went through the letters that we knew that Snowshoe probably carried on his first trip across. And again, this is kind of crossing the streams here, dogs and cats living together. Hal ran down what we think it was a Grosch letter that was carried on Thompson's first trip over the mountains. And Leland Stanford and others. And so Hal had done all that digging for all that of what would be the chances and what would he have carried in his first satchel across the mountains. And so we exposed that to the people. We probably had, 30 or 40 people there? Yeah, and 40. Nice campfire. Everybody brought their own chairs. And the clampers came out. What say the brethren? Satisfactory.
Satisfactory.
So they came out, and of course, they brought a little bit of their own grog. So we tasted that. That was a hoot. And just great people. One of Bill Holmes's friends that he worked with in Cal Fire came out and brought us a little reinforcement of some of the local grog and the book that she'd written during her service at Cal Fire, which was kind of cool. So we got to pass that one around when we get the chance to read it. But, you know, we had a really great time with the folks around the campfire and turned in around 9:30. And we just slept out in the parking lot. No tents, just tarps, sleeping bags. And it was just fantastic. Other than Hal almost got eaten by the coyotes.
And there was a lot of snoring.
Yeah. Well, that was pretty bad because Bob and I and Bill, the guy that got us that campsite, were all lined up in a row on a couple of tarps next to each other, and we were competing wildly for the king of the Snorefest.
I was about 20 feet away, and actually, this hat's a very good sound dampener. So I just
tighten it down. Yeah. Well, Hal, you survived the coyotes, so that's a good thing. So, what was it like on that last day, waking up and then just kind of doing that final stretch in? And what happened at the very, very end when you arrived?
I was glad to see the sunrise because those coyotes were getting closer and closer and closer. I was more concerned with their, you know, how they sing at night. You know, you can hear them getting closer. But yeah, that was a wonderful evening. You know, the Carson Valley, through what Tim just described and where we continue north to Genoa, is an absolutely beautiful place. The eastern side of the Sierras, snow covered. We had very little snow on the ground by this time. It melted. We, off in the distance, you can see Diamond Valley, where Snowshoe Thompson used to live. And the route is really kind of unremarkable in the sense that it's relatively flat terrain. Rolls a little bit, which was good for us. I mean, we'd gone over the Sierra, so there was very little elevation change and nothing strenuous in that respect. But the excitement built. You know, I think we had a 12 or 13 mile day, got up early and went by countless historic old ranches and that sort of thing along the way. Way stations or a Pony Express station, that sort of thing. And as we got closer, and of course, we had this gentleman with us who not only camped with us, but he was from the Carson River Trails Association. They were the hosts for that Faye Luther campsite. And he wanted to hike in with us, and he filled us full of information and some history along the way. We stopped just a short distance before we got into Genoa proper by post office. Bob had arranged with Charles Wegman from New Jersey who is a descendant of the Grosch brothers, who sent him an envelope. I'll let Bob describe all that later. But and then into town, and a nice welcoming reception from the folks there. Took in another, 3/4 or a mile to the cemetery, where the Eclampus Vitus, or the Clampers, had arranged for a ceremony, and that John Thompson's gravesite, where both his wife and son are buried. Very entertaining, very somber. But then back into town at the town hall for 1 o'clock gathering of probably over 100 people in the town hall that wanted to ask us questions. We somehow pulled off, despite our weariness, we were able to answer questions and give a brief presentation. So it was a welcome sight, and to get to the town of Genoa, a historic town, its first settlement in all of that Utah territory back in the day. It used to be known as Mormon Station. Great place.
Town, beautiful town.
Just amazing. I mean, yeah, it's one thing to do this. It's another thing to do this and have all the media attention and the people and communicating constantly. I'm sure, like, you come in, I mean, you're obviously on a high doing these every day, but you know, you're tired, you want to kind of rest and all that, and there's a lot going on, so you're still talking to people up right up until you turn in. And sort of related to that, and I guess I'll ask you, Jen, I wanted to sort of just get a sense too of what the support crew is doing, because obviously if you had to then also set up camp and do everything in that realm and then break everything down the next day, I mean, that would just add so much more effort to this. What was it like and who was supporting you?
Well, you're right. I've done it 30 days by myself, and I've done it with having a person who takes care of your needs. And there's just night and day indifference. And so we are very lucky. We're very lucky. We have a huge support crew, and they're just amazing. They just give and give and give. I don't know what we give back to them. They sure take care of us out there. So we have a variety of people. Matt Keys and Craig Thornley are kind of the, I'd say they're the technical specialist when it comes to rafting, or if there's a rope to be set up on a dangerous crossing, that's the kind of stuff they cover. They also set up the fire pit. We have Bruce, who does all of the tent setup, which is a thankless job. He has to stomp the snow down, make sure it's level, put up all these, you know, tent wind with guy wires. So he is really a great engineer of paths and setting up tents. So he's usually off in the cold by himself while we're getting the fire set up. Then we have Bo, who was our local Nevadian, who, is that a word? I don't know. But he was a wealth of information, and he went around introducing, say, he would say to Hal and Bob, I have a friend that lives down the road. He is from he's three generations of this family from the area. And he would take them out to go meet that person. And he was full of information about the Thompson homestead, and explaining how to pronounce the word Nevada to Bob was a big, big job of his. So we can talk about that later, but Bob went to a meeting in Nevada where he said it incorrectly so many times that he almost got thrown out of the meeting. So our local guy, Bo, was helping us with our pronunciation and with the way things are done in the native land outside of California. And then who am I forgetting here? We did provide food. I was going to say, and Scott is the daddy of the whole thing. He drives the car, he gasses it up, he gets the water, the food. He solves snafus like the parking lot not being plowed. He had to navigate that situation. No, coming in exhausted, and there's no place to camp. So he solves everything else and gets us all of our things. And we give him a long to-do list every day and shout things at him all day. And he's always nice about it. So the only part I took this year, I cooked the dinners ahead of time. And I just kept saying, are you sure there's enough ice? You know, it's four nights. We're waiting to eat these dinners. But yes, he sets up camp and they just do a fabulous job. And we sometimes get up in the morning and just leave our tents in place, and they have to figure out how to get everything put in the truck. And we just off we go on our merry way. Yeah. So we're pretty spoiled some mornings. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll have to add here, you know, Bo, our friend from Reno, he's a really good athlete. He's actually Swedish, so we kind of neighbor of Norway. But it was fascinating because he has all the local information. You know, one of the biggest earthquake faults is right outside of Genoa, and he's a rock nerd. So he gave us the full money on the earthquake fault there. But he was the guy when we did the evening last night, when we did our campfire, he went up to a friend of his and he knew Russell Scassa. You know how Michel the Scassas were married to Snowshoe? Russell Scassa, who's one of the Scassa descendants, came down and came down to the fire pit and gave us the rundown on the family. So, you know, connecting 1860 with 2024 is pretty cool. Much like when we did our Donna Relief exhibition finish, and we said anybody here is alive as a result of the Forlorn Hope, and three or four people, or the relief parties, three or four people raise their hands. You know, you make that connection and it kind of gives you goosebumps. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I remember you telling that story. Yeah, it is incredible, just the longevity of the family lines around here, and they settle in and this is it.
So I got one more for you, connection. So we were just exiting the town hall afterwards, and Scott's trying to find Bob, and Bob's hiding. And you know, we can't find him, and finally he finds him and he says, I need a hat. Well, somebody that was in the town hall wanted a hat. We had that logo we have on the back of our trapper hats on regular ball caps. That was kind of our on the road thing. And yeah, like Jen has it right there. And there was this little girl, she had about 10 years old. She says, you're the shyest person ever. Do you think I could get one of your caps? And Scott's like, you know, yeah, I can totally get your cap. Well, she was like the great, 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 great grandniece of Snowshoe Thompson.
Oh,
at the time.
No,
so we were like, and we're like, this is so cool, we're making the connection.
Her mom introduced her, and Scott, you know, Scott's like the biggest heart, you know, biggest dad. He got down on one knee and said, I think Bob said to her, you have a very big responsibility. And you know, Scott asked her what color she wanted, and so it was really nice to see that being passed down, that she was getting to meet these people that were honoring her ancestor.
That's such a great way to close the circle. Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I just wanted to wrap up with you, Elka, if you want to kind of just give us some final thoughts, maybe on behalf of the whole team, and you know what this one was like, maybe versus the original expedition. What's it been like, and what's next, I guess, if you can speak to it.
Yeah, I don't know that we know what's next. That's something that we have to meet about and discuss and sort of talk about, you know, unwrap everything that happened on this one. But, you know, the story of Snowshoe Thompson was one that we all got pretty excited about. And so that was kind of a no-brainer when we tossed up different ideas. I think it was a overwhelming vote for Snowshoe Thompson. So just as we dug in more about the history of him, and, you know, it was also an area that we hadn't explored yet. So, you know, thanks to Hal and Bob primarily for doing all the recon to figure out what was the best route to take for the team, and just all the logistics that went into it. And again, a little unfortunate being sick for the first couple of days, but I was just really grateful to be able to join the team and just to hear the stories of what they went through on the first 2 days. Just incredible. And again, it takes a village for them to be able to get that raft ride across the South Fork of the American River was phenomenal. And, you know, just all the day-to-day stories that no matter how difficult it is, everybody pushes forward. Everyone's attitudes are always 100%, always. No one ever goes south on anything. So, you know, again, expedition number 4, total success. 11 out of 10 would do it again.
Well, love it. Yeah.
And one guy we failed to mention, though, if you see any of the really rich media content we have from our team, that's really the result of Keith Sutter's magic artistic work. He makes all of our butts look a lot smaller when he takes the pictures because they're not really that small. But yeah, Keith is just amazing. And he's a great guy to have with you out on the trail.
I saw some drone shots that were just fantastic. Yeah. So kudos to him for sure. And betting with you.
Quiet, you don't know he's there. So sometimes we'll say, oh gosh, someone get a picture of Keith, because we're not allowed to look at him or acknowledge him as we ski and walk by. He's got us trained not to look at him, not to talk to him. And so sometimes, you know, like a good photographer, you're unaware of his presence and you just act natural.
I think he was about ready to quit when we were trying to ski down. He goes, okay, each one of you ski down past me. And then first person would ski down and pile into the snow. The second person pile up. He's just like, can anybody ski like 100 yards without hanging a tree?
Just stay upright for 5 seconds.
I mean, it was a blooper reel for sure.
Yeah, we'll fix that in post-processing.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you all. You know, you've just finished days ago. You've made the time for us here and our community. We're so thankful for that. I know you've got a lot of things going on. You've already had some interviews. You were doing interviews all throughout immediately after. And you also have an event in Auburn sponsored through the State Theater. They're currently under some renovations right now. So it's going to be held, I believe, in the Odd Fellows Lodge, 7 o'clock on Friday, this Friday on the 15th. So if you want to come meet the team in person and get even more stories and more insights to this amazing human being, Snowshoe Thompson, and all of his efforts, please come to that. I'm sure that's just going to be an absolute fantastic night. So again, thank you all. We're going to talk to you a little bit more in the post show here. We're going to wrap it up for the main show right now. So, and I know Jessica's got a couple more things to talk about, and then we'll move to the post show.
Yeah, our iconic now. Congratulations, Corner. Well, quickly, but we're so happy to acknowledge again, Cooney. He crushed another 50-mile finish at Muck Marin Ultra Challenge. Congratulations, Cooney. He's coming off of a year battling some health issues. So we're really, he gives back so much. He's kind. He's amazing to any international runners. So Cooney, congratulations for another finish. We also have seen some female local Western States lottery entrants crushing it on the trail. So Shannon Krogsger, I always mess up her name. I love her so much. She just had a baby not too long ago, and she's in Western States for the first time. And I just saw that she crushed her first 20-mile training run. I'm so happy for her. And then we also saw Paula Hamilton. She's at Salmon Falls doing a 50K. She is just so lean and quick and wonderful. So congratulations to both of those local runners. We can't wait for your Western States journey. And, you know, this is part of it now, and we get to see you guys doing it. So congratulations. And then our listeners have been waiting for like a week now because I teased everyone about our new sponsor. So I am so glad to announce we have our new sponsor, which is Flip Mitts. So they're one of a kind. They're an Arizona-based company. They have three features. So they can just be worn like this for gloves. They can be like this. And then when your hands get too hot, you flip them down and they become sweatbands. Or I've done this as well. You can pull them and make them kind of like half sleeves. So they're really cool. They're made with bamboo, so they're super absorbent. They're washable, eco-friendly. And yeah, we're so happy to be partnering with them. They gave us a giveaway pair. So we're going to be posting about this pretty soon. So thank you, FlipMitts, for trusting us with your brand. And we're so excited about them all seasons. They're good for hiking, biking, all the things. So thankful, FlipMitts. We have gone over time, which I'm so excited about because there's so much good storytelling here. We're going to have a quick post show. Any Patreon members or anyone who sends us a dollar on Venmo right now can join us or hang out with us. Otherwise, we thank you guys so much for joining us. Thank you, Bob and Tim and Jennifer and Hal and Elka. So thankful for your time, guys.
Thank you. This is, as I said in the beginning, we're so proud of what you both have done for our community. It shows, it matters. And just by the amount of love that comes back to you, it's a reflection of what you're giving to us. So thank you.
Thank you so much. You. I appreciate it.
Go ahead and send them off, Greg.
All right, everybody. We will see you on the trails. Have a good night.